You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, July 27th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Colin Woodward, author of Union, struggled to forge the story of United States nationhood. Also on the program today, the Republican Senate dithers as millions are set to become evicted and enhanced unemployment insurance set to expire. Meanwhile, Trump's national security advisor tests positive for COVID. The largest vaccine phase 3 test with 30,000 people starts today. Meanwhile, protests continue as Trump threatens to deploy 75,000 federal goons to states around the country. Speaking of which, Trump's handling of corona polling at an all-time low, and not coincidentally, Joe Biden's lead in battleground states grows. Tom Cotton denies he believes slavery is a necessary evil for this country. It's good that he clarified that. And in the wake of Sinclair Media's featuring the plandemic conspiracy, Anthony Fauci needs security for himself and his family. All this and more on today's program. Thanks for joining us. It's the first show that we are having since the passing of Michael Brooks. And, you know, look, this is going to be weird. It's going to be weird for a long time. It's going to be weird for you folks listening and watching the show. It's going to be weird for us doing the show. At times, it's going to be sad. At times, it's, you know, hopefully maybe we can make a couple of jokes at Michael's expense. I understand that he is not able to joke back. But I will, for an extended period of time, allow for people to call in to the show in the fun half, with, impersonating his impersonation of me. But it's gotta be good. Don't call in with a half-assed one, because, Michael wouldn't have stood for that, and I will not either. But over the weekend, yesterday, actually, there was a very, very small memorial for Michael up in Massachusetts. Obviously, there are COVID restrictions, and despite the fact that it's a weird thing to go to a memorial service and not be able to hug anybody, or comfort anybody because, of the pandemic that is raging now. And despite the fact that, you know, everyone, was wearing masks and we were in a big field and there was, in a big circle and kept 6 feet apart. It was a beautiful ceremony. It was, I was very, I felt very fortunate to be able to sort of, I had met a couple of members of his family before, but to meet his entire family and to meet sort of representatives of different parts of Michael's life, and both in terms of, I guess, segments of his life and both from a temporal standpoint and in terms of like an interest standpoint. And people were some very moving just shares, I guess, of the people's experience with Michael. And it was a lovely ceremony. And, you know, there was a little bit of humor there, as I think he would want. And, you know, there's going to be, you know, we're going to try and commemorate Michael on this program. And I know that the guys over at TMBS are going to be doing stuff to commemorate Michael. One of the things we're thinking about is maybe, I don't know if we'll be able to do it in time this Thursday, but maybe for the month of August, we will play on Thursdays some repeats of some of his interviews. How you can help in that process is to send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Put in the subject line "For Michael." And if there is a specific interview that he did on a Thursday or really, you know, from this show, you know, the TMBS guys will are, you know, are dealing with that stuff. But from this show over the years, if there's a specific interview, if there's a specific segment, and help us out. Give us the date of the interview if you can. If it's a segment, don't just write, you know, that one time that he did this. If you can help us by looking for the segment and pointing us to it or sending a link, that will help us incredibly. We're all a little out of sorts. And you know, there are, you know, material implications of his passing, but there's also a lot of emotional implications of his passing. So anything you can do to make that process easier for us, that would be great. But we're going to commemorate him that way. And then we're coming up with other ideas. We will let you know those as they go on. And, you know, bear with us. At times, we're going to have moments where I imagine we're going to be sad. We're also going to have moments. I know that I'm going to try and make jokes about Michael. Not, you know, I'm not going to just keep knocking the guy, but you know, in part to keep his memory alive, and in part just because that's the way we're going to deal with it. So, you know, bear with us. Give us a little benefit of the doubt. I mean, there may be times where, you know, I don't know. I can contemplate times where we make a joke about Michael and some people might say, would he take offense to that? I'm quite sure he would not. Give us the benefit of the doubt in those moments. And that's it. So we're going to try and do our best, move forward, normalize things in a, you know, the latest in the new normals that we're all dealing with in many respects. And, you know, tomorrow we're going to start ads on the show. And we're just going to, you know, keep trying to move forward, continue various aspects of Michael's project. And I know they're talking over at TMBS and David and Matt are talking to Alicia, Michael's sister, and they're trying to figure out what the best way to move forward with the things that Michael was working on. And so, you know, we will do the same. With that said, the people are, we are dealing with the situation in this country right now, obviously, where apparently the president has pivoted a little bit to acknowledging that maybe there should be something done about the coronavirus. And that is that masks are not evil. And that seems to be about it. No money for contact tracing, no money to bulk up the testing capacity. I got an email from someone last week, maybe it was a week before, when we were talking about testing, and they said they work in a lab. The big problem is there's just simply a lack of people who have the technical skills to do this, and sort of secondary supply chain issues. By secondary, I mean like reagents and I don't know, swabs, stuff that could be provided to these facilities with the invocation of the Defense Production Act. And the idea that Donald Trump will not invoke this is absurd. So much of what we're witnessing now almost defies explanation. Just in terms of response to something that is real. And so, we'll talk about that. But on the other end of this is the fact that we're going to have to reshut the economy in many states around the country. And we are starting to see bad economic numbers head back in the wrong direction. And we are days away from millions of people beginning the process of being evicted from their homes. And we are days away from seeing millions of people lose a significant portion of the unemployment benefits they've been getting for the past 3 months or so. Because I don't even know why. It doesn't even make sense on their own terms. Here is Steve Mnuchin. Let's start with this one. This is clip number five. Here's Steve Mnuchin at a press hearing. Right now, a COVID economic relief bill is tied up in the Senate because they can't figure out the best way to deny Americans robust is not the right word, adequate unemployment benefit. They really desperately want to do that. And they're just trying to figure out technically the best way of doing it. Here's Mnuchin.
But the fundamental issue, and we all acknowledged, there was a technical problem where we were in emergency last time, so we instituted this quickly. And in certain cases, people were paid more to stay home than they were to work. And I think that's something that the American public understands. We're not going to use taxpayer money to pay people more to stay home. So we're going to transition to a UI system that is based upon wage replacement. We've talked about approximately 70% wage replacement. And we're just going through the mechanics of that.
All right. So,
and there's very strong.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Keep playing it. I didn't realize there was another clip.
Very strong tax incentives, tax credits in this bill to get people back to work.
First of all, the premise is insane. We should be paying people to stay home from work. That's exactly what we should be doing if we were taking this pandemic seriously. If we realized the mistake that we had made in the first instance, which was not aggressively paying people to stay home across the board, because you had states like Florida or Texas that didn't want to pay unemployment insurance, we should be paying people to stay at home. And there is a small amount of people who are getting paid more to stay at home than they would have had they had their job existed. There's no guarantee that the job exists anyways. But so what? So what? It has helped the economy. It is the only thing that's keeping the economy afloat. You can still have consumer spending if the government pays people to stay home. And it's the consumer spending that's keeping everything afloat at this point. It's the only thing that is going to diminish the amount of people who are being evicted. It's utterly bizarre. And be clear on what's happening. The average benefit that a state gives when you get unemployment insurance is about 45-50%. Depends on the state. Sometimes it can be a little bit higher, sometimes a little bit lower. The federal government, instead of saying we're going to give an extra 20-25% or whatever it is, just said blanket number $600 per person per week. In some instances, that brought people up to, I don't know, 75% of wages, 80%, 90%, 105%, 110%. And now they're trying to figure out, well, how can we technically make sure that we don't have any people who are getting above 70%? This is just, it's madness. Here he is on Chris Wallace. And even Chris Wallace on Fox News is like, well, wait a second. It's a good thing to pay people to stay at home, A, and B, it's also the only thing that's keeping the economy afloat.
That the GDP number for the second quarter nationally will not be the plus 1 or 2 or 3% that we normally see, but instead for the second quarter will be something like minus 33%. One, is that what we should expect to see, a contraction of the economy by a third in the second quarter? And secondly, if it's anything like that, why would you want to cut back on the $600 stimulus payments, the unemployment benefits? Because there are projections that even if you cut it to around $200, which is basically what I think you're talking about with a 70-75% of wages, there are estimates that that's going to cost millions of jobs.
Well, Chris, we always said the second quarter was going to be a very bad quarter.
Just want to be clear here. Chris Wallace understands that if you inhibit the buying power of the American consumer, that's going to cost other jobs. You're trying to save money with this $200 as opposed to $600 a week thing. But you're going to end up spending it on the other end when you knock more people out of work. It's insanity. And Mnuchin, remember, in that last clip, is like, well, we have tax incentives to bring people back to work. It literally is the functional equivalent of saying, like, we're not only going to not pay people to jump off the cliff, we're going to encourage them by forcing them to jump off the cliff and then also make it even more fun for them by giving them tax incentives when they jump off the cliff.
Again, that's not for economic reasons. That's for health reasons. We literally shut down the entire economy. And I think, as we've said, we expect the third quarter, the consensus is 17% GDP. So we do think you're going to see a very big rebound. I might just also comment on June retail sales were 1% higher than June of last year. So all that money we pumped into the economy, it worked. People went out and spent. And on the, you know, as it relates to the unemployment insurance, again, I think workers and Americans understand the concept that you shouldn't be paid more to stay home than to work, that the fair thing is to replace wages. And it just wouldn't be fair to use taxpayer dollars to pay more people to sit home than they would get working and get a job.
It's just insanity. Have people been complaining about the fairness of keeping the economy afloat because people who work at sub-living wages are now actually making slightly more? It's just absurd. It really is absurd. And in many respects, it's inexplicable. It's just, I guess, their ideology, or I don't know. You would imagine that Donald Trump, seeing that he's losing in the polls in battleground state after battleground state, would say, hey, like, guys, why don't we just give money? It's almost like they just sort of, I don't know, some type of kabuki. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we do, we'll come back with journalist Colin Woodward, author of Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of the United States Nationhood. Be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the state national affairs writer for the Portland Press Herald, Maine Sunday Telegram, and the author of multiple books, the most recent of which, Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of the United States Nationhood. Colin Woodward, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
We had you on in 2015. For American Nations, which I would encourage everybody to go back and listen to that interview, because that that's a fascinating story as well. And in many respects, this is almost like a sequel in some respects. Maybe that's too strong of a word, but But before we do, let me go into my Rachel Maddow thing for a moment. Because I want to talk about how when I went to high school, we would drink beers in parking lots and in back behind the school. There was something called Newton Hill, and we would drink there. And sometimes we would drive up to an old castle. Was it really a castle? I mean, sort of like a tower, stone tower. And we would drink there, and it was also like a cruising place at the time, and it was called Bancroft Tower, and it was named after George Bancroft in Worcester, Massachusetts. And lo and behold, George Bancroft is one of the, maybe not the, but I would say the protagonist of your book, and it's a fascinating story. I had no idea. And so,
native son of Worcester,
indeed, and well, also I, as am I. So, tell us about. Let's just start with George Bancroft, and then we'll broaden back out for a moment.
Sure. Well, when I was writing American Nations, which in essence argues that there's never been one America but several Americas, and each of them tie back to the differences between the early colonies that settled on the eastern and southwestern rims of the country, and those distinctions can be felt today. So in writing Union, my task was to understand how it is that we came to think otherwise. Where did our sort of myth or story of United States shared nationhood come from, and who created it and when? And that effort quickly brought me to George Bancroft, who was he's largely forgotten today outside of Worcester, but he was the most preeminent and celebrated historian in the United States throughout the 19th century and a statesman as well. He ended up serving as Secretary of War under President Polk's administration, Secretary of the Navy, and created the Naval Academy at Annapolis, served as an ambassador. He was a major figure, and it was he who created the first draft of our story of what the purpose of the United States was, where it came from, what held us together, what our special glue was that would hold our entirely separate regional cultures together. And he was a really interesting person. He was a New Englander through and through, born in 1800, and was the son of a leading congregational minister, a descendant of the early Puritans, attended Phillips, Exeter, and Harvard, graduated at 17 or 18, and was sent by the president of Harvard at the time to earn what was then a very rare thing, a doctorate. You could only essentially get a PhD in Germany at the new research universities that were there. He went to Germany and studied under the people who were creating the sort of European and German ideas of what a nation should be. His professors were Hegel and Herring and the Van Humboldts. And then he comes back to New England, and he ends up eventually creating this story through a series of incredibly popular histories of what the United States is supposed to be, that fuses his New England upbringing, the idea that, you know, that the Puritans had, that they were a covenanted people. They had a special relationship with God who'd tasked them to do certain things in the world. He took that idea, an errand in the wilderness to build a, you know, put a light on the hill to create a more godly society, and fused it with the German romantic nationalist thinking about how each nation was like a living organism, that they grew from a seed from preconceived instructions, and would inevitably, the seed would flower into the adult organism with all these special characteristics. And so Bancroft fused those two together and believes that although it appeared that places like South Carolina and Massachusetts and the Dutch settled area around New York City and the Appalachian backcountry and so on had entirely different ethnographic and religious characteristics and histories and had been enemies and rivals throughout the colonial period and had very little in common prior to their shared revolutionary struggle, that indeed, actually, they had all been planted by the same seed that was all growing to create this one American nation that was destined and tasked by God to carry the mantle of freedom forward, that the ideals in the Declaration of Independence were sort of guided by providence, and that that was what would hold us together, and that we were destined to spread across the continent and to carry the baton of freedom for all humanity forward. So all these ideas you hear, you know, about American exceptionalism, about us having some, you know, special, maybe God-endorsed purpose in the world, that was all properly packaged and put together and brought out into the public space by George Bancroft to kick off what ended up being a epic and harrowing fight over what the United States, you know, national story and nationhood would actually be.
And obviously, and we will get, it really takes about 100 years from his birth, I guess, until that gets levied there. So, I want to just jump out for a second and just the relevance of national histories. I mean, I think, tell us what the relevance of a national history is. Because that is, your book is about the sort of this competition on some level that was going on to create that national history. What's the relevance of them to us, let's say, today?
Yeah, and to people everywhere. I mean, it's often conveyed through the writing of histories, but it's the creation of your national story, your national narrative that you tell yourselves about who you are. Because remember, nations are abstract concepts. They're sort of imagined communities, whether you're in, you know, Japan or Canada or the United States or Thailand. The idea that we all belong to some extended tribe or family is something that we, you know, construct in our heads. And to do that, to imagine as individuals that we have more loyalty to this very large subset of people than to these other subsets of people who belong to other nations, requires a whole story that we can build that makes that credible. So it's essential for any nation's survival and creation to have that, to have a story that says where we came from, who we are, and where we're going. And that varies from nation to nation, but you can't really establish and create something that will have that loyalty from individuals unless you can successfully do that. And nations are pretty new things. You know, really, it's only the past, you know, 300 or 400 years that there have been nation states the way we think of them now. And the United States had a particularly challenging set of circumstances at its birth to try to create such a story, to try to get people in Massachusetts or in South Carolina to think of themselves in a genuine way as Americans first rather than as South Carolinians or Massachusettsians.
For a long time, it was just simply, for a long time, it was just simply, you are the people of the king, essentially. And
absolutely.
Here's the story of our nation. God said, I'm the ruler, and I deemed it that you should be part of my nation. End of story.
Right. Or not even the word nation used, just that you're part of my kingdom. And if the nation, you know, if I marry some other person and their dowry comes with all these other sections of the planet, that they just suddenly magically become under my kingdom, you know, without any definition of nationhood, or doesn't matter what, you know, what language you speak or anything else. It was a very different set of ideas than we're used to now. And I think people make the mistake of assuming that like medieval kingdoms were nations when they really weren't. So yeah, this is a pretty new thing. And however, you know, very important with an enormous impact on history. Well, for Americans, we didn't have a common language. All of the different colonies had totally different histories. They've been founded by people at different times with different ethnographic and religious characteristics who were building very different societies with different original intents. You know, like I said, they'd often be enemies. And so they didn't have a common history. They didn't have a common set of ideals that they were pursuing. We couldn't think of ourselves as having lived in this, you know, homeland since before the lifting of the mists of time, because we've all shown up in, you know, just the past 200 years or so at best. We couldn't think of ourselves as this being our, you know, indigenous place, because the European settlers who had come had expropriated the continent from the native inhabitants who were there and were causing them to be non-citizens in formal and informal ways. So in it, all of the things that many other countries were using to build this idea of nationhood were essentially deprived to the founders of the United States. And yet, you know, by the early 19th century, it was clear that we needed such a story, or all the centripetal forces were going to tear the country apart. There'd already been secession movements, you know, in the Appalachian backcountry during the Whiskey Rebellion, New England considering secession during the War of 1812, the growing schisms over slavery and the implications that had for our founding document, the Declaration of Independence, with its decree that, you know, all people are born inherently equal, which a race-based slave system stood in opposition to. So all of these forces required that you needed to come up with a story. It was a national security crisis. And you ask about the relevance today. I mean, if we fast forward all the way to now, you're seeing some of that crisis played out today, where, you know, what is it that really holds us together, given the different political pressures that are also geographically defined? You know, what is it that is the common threads that will hold our union and hold Americans together as people is, I think, a relevant question out there. And some of the answers lie in this story.
I can answer that question. We are now the most infected people in the world, and no one wants to have us infect them. So that was.
And what sort of, I mean, a sort of a failure of the American project and of federalism, you're seeing it there, right? We're all witnessing our country fail at a fundamental level, at the federal level, to protect its citizens, and the response to this existential crisis being passed on to states and municipalities, and people are all over the map. And if you map the results of the pandemic, there are massive differences at a geographical level.
So
all of this is really relevant.
Yeah, I actually want to get to that. I mean, I read a piece that you did about that relative to the history of the 11 regional cultures of North America. But so let me ask you this: how conscious, and you write about five figures whose national histories are in some respect in competition with each other: Bancroft, Williams, Sims, Douglas, Woodrow Wilson, how conscious were these writers, and particularly Bancroft, because he's the earliest, how conscious were they of the need for what you were talking about? Like, or how much did they express an awareness of, my challenge is to find a cohesion here in this history? to tease this out or to generate it?
Yeah, an excellent question. And the story starts with the beginning with Bancroft, and I ended it when one of the competing visions, and there's essentially two threads that fought with each other, when one of them became dominant over the whole Federation. And so it spans nearly a century. But in the early part, when you have George Bancroft and his deep Southern rival, William Gilmore Sims, fighting over the meaning of the United States, they were very conscious of what they were doing and conscious that they were trying to define the United States as a nation in one direction or another. And of course, the William Gilmore Sims, who was from Charleston in the Deep South, had a very different argument. You know, Bancroft had said that the ideals in the Declaration of Independence about unalienable rights and humans being, born inherently equal, that was completely wrong, that humans were obviously not equal, and that there was a hierarchy in humanity, and only the allegedly superior Anglo-Saxon race had the wisdom and brilliance to be Republican citizens and to see the promise of the United States in the Declaration, and that the real nations were, South Carolina and Massachusetts and Georgia and so on. But what they shared in common was this allegedly superior Anglo-Saxon identity, and that they would form this confederation or federation that would, like the EU, defend them collectively, have trade agreements and provide for defense, but that the real sovereignty would lie at an earlier level. And that battle, that the consciousness that was what they were doing, was front and center in what they and their colleagues were talking about during this intellectual and public debate that lasted all the way into and after the Civil War. And Frederick Douglass, who comes in as the pivotal figure in the story, is very conscious of this battle over the soul of the country in very explicit terms. But by the time you get to the latter two, Frederick Jackson Turner, the great historian of the West, and Woodrow Wilson, future president and virulent white supremacist in the William Gilmore Sims tradition. Remember, this is now the post-Civil War, and the United States is becoming an industrial power and more sure of itself. So they were taking a vision that was already there and picking up one banner or the other, modifying it for their new circumstances and carrying it forward. But they didn't have to invent the traditions from the beginning. So that wasn't where their heads were at exactly. They were saying, oh, look back, the past 50 years, and I can tie together a story that is better than the competing story.
It also is sort of stunning to me that, there's a lot of between Bancroft and Wilson and Turner, there's a lot that goes down in the United States at that time, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of changing the history. I've come to see the Reconstruction as sort of a second founding of the country in some ways. And it's fascinating to me that by the time you get to Turner's, sort of history that wins out on some level, or I should say Wilson's, that Reconstruction is sort of, almost.
It's seen as a disaster.
Yeah.
Precisely denied. Because you tried to imagine that other races could be equal to the great Anglo-Saxons. That was the explicit argument they made. The argument that Wilson made in his histories and in his academic work, and that he practiced as president right through to the, segregating of the federal government and the championing of the first great Hollywood blockbuster film that came out during his first term and was co-produced and based on the book by one of his best buddies and graduate school friends, Thomas Dixon Jr., that's Birth of a Nation, which is a book celebrating the Ku Klux Klan's reign of terror to end Reconstruction and successfully roll back the political emancipation of African Americans in the South. It's a film that actually had placards, right? It was a silent film and had placards quoting Woodrow Wilson's history to prove its points on this. So the story of our nationhood, the story told in Union, is basically a battle between a civic national vision, the one that I described with Bancroft, the idea that what in the end ties Americans together is fealty to the ideals in the Declaration of Independence, against an ethnic national description of who we are. The ethno-national idea that, no, there's a subset of people living in the United States who are the true inheritors of the, you know, American project, and that other people are somehow excluded because, in the American context, they lack the capacity to be true true Republican citizens, right? They have fealty to the Pope, or their race is obviously doesn't have the cognitive capacity to do these things. These arguments have been rolled out throughout our history to defend, you know, what was originally an Anglo-Saxon or Anglo-Saxon Protestant supremacy, and later a more broad white supremacy, but still is rolled out to exclude certain people as being culturally or perhaps genetically incapable of, you know, exercising, you know, full humanity under the Constitution and the Declaration. And that's the battle told in our book that carries through to Wilson. And unfortunately, under Wilson is when the ethno-national white supremacist vision wins out in the 1910s and 20s for a time. And it's the first vision that actually wins out and has dominance across the Federation, which is rather a chilling thing to realize. You know, that it was vanquished again by the civic national ideas in the 1960s and has been with us as a dominant force since then. But obviously that ethno-nationalist vision did not get vanquished. We're fighting about it in the streets today and right. In the battle over these monuments and the Confederate flag. So this is a story that we're still living in, and it's the backstory to it. And I hope provide some of the ingredients for how we'd rejuvenate, you know, the better of our two visions, the civic national one, and maybe update it and rejuvenate it for today.
And we should say it is no coincidence at all that a lot of these statues that are being torn down were put up in that very era between 1910 and 1920, at a time where there was something like 6 or 7% of the country were card carrying members of the KKK, right? There was like 6-7 million like out and about proud members of the KKK at that time.
Not a coincidence at all, because Birth of a Nation, this film that Wilson helped endorse and who his friend created, actually was literally the thing that sparked the creation of the second KKK. The people who founded it on the eve of the film opening in Atlanta, they rode up onto a mountainside and, you know, burned a cross up there to officially commemorate a second Klan, and rode down wearing their Klan attire to the opening, where they fit right in, because at the opening, people dressed in Klan hoods and stuff outside the box office to promote the film. That's how, you know, egregious it was. And this is when, Jim Crow really takes hold, and when the Confederate monuments are created. Yeah, it's this high tide that comes in the Wilson administration and in that era, but it's the triumph of that vision with the aftermath of the collapse of Reconstruction and the retelling of the national narrative around this exclusionary and ethno-nationalist definition of, you know, what America is about and who can and can't be a full member of the American project.
And just to be clear too, you write about the attempt of folks to cancel that movie in Boston, where arguably the first, I guess, a civil rights protest take place in regards to that movie.
Yeah, I mean, the parallels are today in that sense too. I mean, I wrote this book, mostly a year and a half ago, so I couldn't have seen this coming. But yeah, the Birth of a Nation had a lot of parallels with the demonstrations we're seeing now. You had this film celebrating this white supremacist triumph in the terrorist campaign during Reconstruction. And at that time, the First Amendment the courts had not yet decided that artistic productions were covered as protected speech. So mayors and governors regularly censored plays and moving pictures that were considered somehow contrary to public morals. So what the protesters were asking for, there were mass protests all across the country, especially in New York and most of all in Boston, yeah, because Boston had been the center of abolitionism, and William Monroe Trotter, the early civil rights leader, organized these huge protests outside the movie theaters. There were clashes with police, but what they were demanding is that the mayor of Boston, or maybe the governor, censor the film, which, given the enormous amount of money that this epic film, a film like had never been seen before had cost. If they had succeeded in censoring the movie in major markets like New York and Boston and Chicago, the filmmakers would have gone bankrupt. Thomas Dixon Jr., Woodrow Wilson's friend, would have gone bankrupt. So that's why it was so important in the middle of those protests that Woodrow Wilson agreed to Thomas Dixon to show Birth of a Nation to his cabinet in the White House in the middle of the protests, a implicit endorsement of the film at a time when mayors and governors were being asked to censor it. And then the next day, on the strength of that, Thomas Dixon ran across town to the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Justice White, and got him to show it to the rest of the Supreme Court justices and the leaders of Congress at one of the biggest hotel ballrooms in Washington, D.C., because the Chief Justice had been in the KKK and thought the message was just wonderful. So you can see how, you know, the battle over these things was, you know, front and center and has a lot of parallels with the fight today.
And that was back when cancel culture lost, I guess, right? I mean, that's what I do find so fascinating is that the that's a perfect example of just, you know, they didn't call it cancel culture, but one could argue that when you're promoting that type of vision of America as white nationalism, you're canceling a significant portion of the people living in the country, right? I mean, like,
or another way to look at it is the cancel culture, a different cancel culture won, right? Because
that's what I mean. Exactly.
Being destroyed, they canceled the African American U.S. senators and the possibility of, yeah, all of that. So yeah,
exactly, like my point. We've always had cancel culture. It's just a question of who has the levers that are doing the canceling at any given time. And so let me ask you this, like, and I'm fascinated by this. What makes one story win when another loses?
Yeah, and how do ideas, how does the struggle of ideas happen, and how does one win and the other lose, and how do they get the upper hand? Those are all questions that I was really interested in writing the book, which is, you know, because ideas are like the most powerful thing in the human experience and can affect our lives and the future of nations and everything else, but they're abstractions. And what makes them real is somebody comes up with the ideas. And it comes out of, you know, their childhood, who their friends were, who their enemies were, what their formative experiences were. And when they clash with another set of ideas, they're clashing with another person or set of people's experiences and stuff. So I wanted to write the book and research the book through the key figures who ended up being the most high profile, you know, warriors for each of these ideas. And so it's written as a multiple biography, like a novel with separate storylines of different people that end up colliding. And so you learn about who these people were and where they got their ideas and what their experiences were and then how they intersect and how in the 19th century, right? George Bancroft is born in 1800 and doesn't die until the 1890s. And the book doesn't end until sort of 1918 or so. But during that whole time period, much of it, the war of ideas took place in written word, in books and articles, but especially in public speeches. And the public speeches would be transcribed by reporters on the scene who would then publish them in the newspaper. And then, like a slow-moving Twitter, they would get retweeted by other newspapers, right? They would get a copy of that paper. They would retype set into their edition and reprint the speech in their paper, sometimes with, you know, scathing, you know, commentary on top. And that was how things would in slow motion retweet across the country. People would counter comment on articles and issue counter speeches. And that's how, for, you know, much of the 19th century, that's where the battles of ideas and politics and everything else happened. And so understanding, you know, how people got onto these stages and who their allies were that would do the retweeting and who would be their enemies who would fight against it and how it would affect government. You know, people like Bancroft and Sims both, you know, served in government. Sims as a legislator and almost as a U.S. senator, and his best friend was governor of South Carolina and later was a U.S. senator just before the Civil War. Bancroft served in cabinets as ambassadors and as the Democratic Party boss in Massachusetts and their gubernatorial, you know, nominee. Woodrow Wilson becomes governor and president. You know, Frederick Jackson Turner is the only one of the group that didn't serve in public office, but was the most famous, you know, historian of the 19th century with this frontier thesis hit that people still talk about and still affects our pop culture. And Frederick Douglass became, you know, one of the most famous international, you know, celebrities of his time, and served as our ambassador to Haiti and in other public positions in Washington, D.C. So they weren't just ivory tower individuals. They were also literally involved in statesmanship and statescraft at the same time. And so all of those things, the intersection between, you know, politics and those with hold their hands on the literal levers of power and these ideas, was something I was very interested in. And watching it evolve as you get towards the end of the book, when you actually have motion pictures and other forms of media starting to form and the power over them, and how it quickly, you know, the very first blockbuster film leads to massive street clashes and protests of the sort that we just talked about, because everyone recognized its enormous power to shape people in the war of ideas.
But what was what were the historical contexts that led to the victory of that idea of ethno-nationalism at that time? So for instance, as an analogy, right? Like, I think a lot of what we've seen in terms of cultural ideas gaining prominence in this era is in some respect a reaction to Donald Trump. I think, I don't know that if Hillary Clinton was president, we would have had a Me Too movement like we've had. I don't know that we would have had the same disposition on what I believe we're on the cusp of a different understanding of immigration in this country as a function of a lot of people just lining up in this polarization. What in that era, and how much, I guess, does like the lost cause, another sort of narrative, sub-narrative, I guess, of our nation, play into that what was going on within the context of the material world that was allowing for that vision of an ethno-nationalism to win in that moment?
Right. I think that the end of the Civil War, everyone would have thought that the civic national vision had won. The one, right. You know, President Lincoln, after meeting with Bancroft and Frederick Douglass a couple times in the White House during the war, and a lot of the thinkers associated with the movements that both of them were drawing from, ends up at Gettysburg declaring essentially that the Civil War is about defense of those civic national ideas and the idea of human equality, which the war hadn't started with. Lincoln hadn't started there. But by the end of it, that was what it appeared to be. And the post, you know, the Reconstruction era amendments, the 13th and 14th and 15th amendments, that second founding of the United States based on those principles, you would have thought it would have been the triumph of civic nationalism. I mean, everyone kind of did. But then in those decades between the end of the Civil War and Woodrow Wilson's presidency, you're right, everything had shifted. And primarily, if you step way back and take the orbital perspective, the hundreds of thousands of lives lost in the Civil War, everyone in white America and then in the white North who would have had to spearhead any effort to force the Confederacy to comply with this new vision, to force the occupied states via Reconstruction to become good civic nationalists and abandon, you know, their schemes for an apartheid-like system to continue in the South. Those people were exhausted by it, in essence, and perhaps not enough of them were committed to begin with the idea that this was about defending civic nationalism as opposed to just, you know, preventing the secession of the Southern states. And so for all those reasons, they just lacked the political and perhaps the public will at the highest levels to push back against a violent, you know, terrorist campaign in the occupied South to destroy Reconstruction. And because of that, you know, the failure to be willing to put up with the continued sacrifices to do that, there needed to be a way that the North and South could come together on different terms. And so basically white Americans, North and South, agreed on a new narrative about what the Civil War was about. They would let go of the idea that it was about the ideals and Declaration of Independence. Oh, we both had honorable ideas and blue and gray both suffered on the battlefield, and now we'll hug and have, you know, blue-gray marriages and nice plantation houses, you know, all that movies that came out about the South afterwards that kind of feature that reconciliation. That's all built into parts of Birth of a Nation, by the way, as well, that whole idea. And that white Americans would be able to come together and reconcile by forgetting about the promise and the declaration, about forgetting about the equality of humans beyond, you know, what was tolerated in the definitions of the Confederate South. And so that all laid the stage for Woodrow Wilson to put the capstone on the South's winning the peace, having lost the war. And all of that, you know, all of that comes out of that period afterwards. Remember, Woodrow Wilson is a little kid during the Civil War. He's living in Columbia, South Carolina, after it's been burned down by Sherman when he's growing up. His father is, you know, a raging white supremacist and the most important charismatic figure in the Presbyterian Church of the Confederacy. I mean, he's brought up, he's lived through all of that I just told you personally. And he brings all of that with him to his conquest of the White House. So that's, I think, at the orbital perspective, how it is that the shift between those two visions ended up laying the groundwork for the ethno-nationalist white supremacist version to dominate in the 1910s and 1920s.
That's fascinating. I had never occurred to me that just sense of exhaustion and the South having a, you know, broadly speaking, more stakes, I guess. I mean, that's why you get a myth like the Lost Cause, and there's no competing myth on some level about the North until maybe, I don't know, maybe that, you know, that competing myth is that, you know, Lincoln was that engaged in terms of slavery. But I think to a certain extent, I mean, he was, but I don't know if there was not a commensurate sort of counter volley to the Lost Cause.
I mean, it was there. This whole civic national tradition we're talking about, starting with Bancroft and promoted much more effectively and with the awareness of our failures to achieve it that Frederick Douglass pushed forward. I mean, there were people fighting for it the whole time, but the reason they lost the battle, they lost the hearts and minds war overall, is because of all those forces we're talking about. And their vision was to encompass the whole United States, not just the North per se, even though that you know, the northern regions or regional cultures that I describe are the ones where that vision was strongest or most compatible with their founding ideas, ironically, since Jefferson was not from those areas. But that's why the ethno-nationalist version was able to win in that period, even when there was a competing idea. And those competing ideas were, you know, were still there in the background. People were still fighting for them. That's why they were able to be grabbed again in the, you know, aftermath of World War II with the building of the civil rights movement that, you know, vanquished that white supremacist, you know, toppled it from being the dominant idea and placed the civic national one at the top again. Even if we weren't achieving it, that was what we all thought the country was supposedly defined on. You know, I'm a Generation Xer and grew up thinking that, you know, we're working towards, you know, that human equality and that the bad old days of the Jim Crow South and segregation are past us. And lo and behold, we've elected an African-American president, right? You know, we're moving forward. And that was, you know, because that was the dominant ethos up until quite recently.
All right. And so I can't let you go without just asking about your last work. And again, I'd recommend people go back and listen. It was in August of 2015, but it's the history of the 11 rival regional cultures of North America. And you have tracked those cultures in terms of the coronavirus response. Sadly, you know, federalism has been suspended, I guess, when it comes to pandemics. Not so much when it comes to protests, but when it comes to pandemics, we suspend it. How is that playing out? The different cultures in our country, defined by region, which ostensibly were defined by different groups of people congregating in specific. I mean, you know, some measure of what they call self-sorting. How is that playing out here?
Right. If you know the map of the early colonization patterns in the United States, which areas were colonized from New England and became a greater New England. New Englanders and their descendants over generations in different tiers of the country, setting out the first, you know, state constitutions and, you know, narratives about who we're supposed to be and institutional ideas, as opposed to the Dutch settled area around New York City and not the rest of New York State. And the, you know, the area that's descended from the Quakers project, William Penn's project in Pennsylvania, and covers another tier going out into the Midwest and the Appalachian backcountry and so on. If you know that map, it's shocking to see the fissures of those tectonic plates in, say, county level metrics of what's happening with the spread of the pandemic. And I've written on that and even crunched numbers. The regional cultures don't follow state lines because the settlement patterns didn't. So some states are riven by strong regional differences like Ohio or Pennsylvania or even Maryland, Texas, California. Different areas were settled by entirely different colonization streams, leading to massive differences. But you can see those differences on the map. And if you calculate the numbers, it follows pretty much what American nations would predict, because one of the biggest differences between these regional cultures is where they lie in the idea of how you create a free society. Do you do it through maximizing individual liberty, or do you maximize it then through protecting the common good and building, a free society and the infrastructure you need to have humans be meaningfully free? In other words, do you maximize the autonomy of the individual, and that's what matters most to be free, or do you perhaps not do that and invest in the common, structures that allow you to cultivate a republican citizenry? So those areas that are strongly on the individual liberty side, lo and behold, are the same areas where there's enormous resistance to wearing masks to protect others because it would somehow restrict your own freedom. Where governors and other top officials have worked, you know, to the advantage of the virus and against public health advice based on the idea that, you know, people's economic and personal liberties should not be infringed even in the face of a deadly virus. Whereas the areas that are more communitarian, where the idea is that you're building and protecting a free community, have been much more likely to follow public health advice, where mask wearing is largely regarded as a good thing and protecting, you know, the common good in each other, even if it's an inconvenience to yourself, takes precedence. And so the rates now in the second wave of virus, you know, the first wave, you know, it was essentially started in places that were well connected to China and northern Italy and also densely populated. And then those got under control and everyone was under control. And we could have been like, say, Canada, where we generally have the virus under control. But instead, we're having a second wave because in places with this individual liberty ethos, where you go have spring break and you have governors stopping cities from having mask ordinances and all the rest, you've seen the disease absolutely explode, even if it as it remains under control in, you know, areas within, say, the greater New England space where those communitarian, functions and ethos exist. And so that we're seeing it, you know, the stark differences in our fundamental and existential characteristics of our federation playing out in the most morbid and awful way possible. And again, it could have been avoided with strong federal leadership,
right,
and, you know, a national strategies. But because the Trump administration abdicated responsibility and has left it all to the states, we're seeing this horrid, you know, ghoulish laboratory of federalism and watching how the different regional cultures would handle what is basically, you know, a public health, you know, common good narrative. And lo and behold, some of them do not handle such things very well at all.
Well, I just find it so fascinating, and that the idea of the sort of like cultural values of people who lived 200 years ago plus resonate in such a an explicit way 200 years later with their great-great-grandkids.
Right. 200 and 400 years later. And, you know, on the political map at the county level and in dialects and polling on different values and issues, it's staggering how much the inertia and legacy of culture can play out, even when the, you know, original people, in quotes, who founded these places are long gone or their descendants are a tiny minority. The inertia of having been the first ones to set out the ideas that the rest of us encountered later when we moved to a place is pretty amazing, and seems to be something about the way humans as social organisms work.
Yeah, I find it fascinating. We will link to a one of those pieces, I think from the Press Herald, at majority.fm, yeah. as we will, too, with Union, the struggle to forge the story of the United States nationhood. Colin Woodward, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. It's fascinating stuff.
Thanks so much. Enjoyed it at any time.
All right, bye-bye. All right, folks. I would recommend you go back and listen to his interview. I believe it was August 27th of 2015, about those 11 regional things. And you could also listen and or read about Deep Roots, how slavery still shapes the Southern politics, which also is another example of just how resonant and durable these cultural ideologies are. I don't know what better way to put it. Cultural ideas, values are generations later. And when you begin to understand that, you know, so much of where we are today is a function of ideas that people had two, 400 years ago. It's fascinating. It gives you a sense in many respects, you know, what you're fighting against at different times, how deep these ideologies are within people. We're going to take a break, go into the fun half. This is one of those moments where I would say, you know, become a member, join themajorityreport.com. I pitch, obviously, for justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Sign up for the AM Quickie at amquickie.com. We also have merch, shop at shop.majorityreportradio.com. And this would be, you know, the point in the show where I would plug Michael's show. I think tomorrow night they are going to the TMBS crew is going to put together memorial remembrance for Michael. But go back, watch some of the old shows, TMBS shows, and pass them around. There's a lot of stuff that Michael put out over the past couple of years, in particular, that are histories, and will have as much relevance, 5 years from now as they did over the past couple of years. So check that stuff out. And again, a reminder: if you have an idea of some of Michael's best of interviews from the Majority Report over the years, ones that stuck with you, or moments, send us an email, majorityreporters@gmail.com. Write for Michael in the subject line. We're going to, over the next month, run some of those in his memory on Thursdays. And, and then we'll take it from there. But so check that out. Also, obviously, everybody has been doing remembrances of Michael. You can check out Nomiki's show, the Nomiki show on patreon.com and on youtube.com. The Nomiki show. Check that out. Also, the Antifada. Jamie, are you here?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yep. Jamie, what do you guys have this week on the Antifada?
This week on the Antifada, we released an episode last Wednesday about housing. We talked to Nate Post Cyborg of the Line Goes Down crew and Tank, Tenant and Neighborhood Councils, which is a pretty radical and militant tenant union out of the East Bay about the ongoing housing crisis, how it's being accelerated by COVID, what tenants can do to fight back. We also talked about some fun little news items like the shady feds invading Portland, the dropping fertility rate, the Mary Trump interview, and the cancel culture letter. Also on Friday, Andy released an episode of Prolet Cult, his little side project about technology, conspiracy theories, space communism, etc. They talk about the meme wars and the role that internet memes can play in politics. And then this weekend, I just want to tease it. We recorded an episode on Hong Kong and the uprising there, and I was a little intimidated by the subject at first, but I know that Michael would have told me to go for it, so I did, and I'm stoked to release that on Wednesday.
Great. Not sure what's happening on Literary Hangover. Matt will be back tomorrow, and we'll update us on that. Jamie, I think you got to check during, we're going to cross over. Check your computer. I think your sound is coming through your computer and not through your microphone. So just check that in the go into your preferences on your computer and make sure you get the right input. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half. We'll see you in the fun half. 646-257-3920. We'll take some calls, take some IMs.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danarchy's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danarchy.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break for people.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck. Fucking reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. 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 A hell of a lot of bang.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black.
Come on! West, come on! West, come on!
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy, 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 pussy.